I know to be true when we're honest about where we're at, we help people.
And my sponsor used to always say, first thought wrong, first thought wrong, first thought wrong. Like, whatever your first thought is, throw it out the window, go get a second opinion. Like, don't follow your ideas. Put it out there to somebody. And then I would look back and my first thought was always pretty destructive. Still is. Yeah. My first reflex is pretty destructive. Yeah.
I have to say, I don't have to make an amends. I mean, that to me is like the most amazing thing. Is able to not burn the fucking house down.
Hey, sober people and sober adjacent people. Welcome to I Have 12 Questions. I'm Amanda Patton, your host, the leading expert on nothing. However, I am in recovery and I love it. So much so that I launched this podcast where we get to talk to people who are trudging the road to happy freaking destiny across all the different ways that people get there. So while this is definitely through the lens of recovery and sobriety, the stories and the themes that we'll be covering are universally human. So love, loss, grief, excitement, parenting, outside issues, purpose, God stuff, whatever. In the words of the great Ted Lasso by way of Walt Whitman, I want to be curious, not judgmental. So like I said, we'll be talking to people in recovery. We're going to be talking to experts and practitioners who help those people along their path in recovery. And we're just really excited to hear people tell their stories and to be inspired by them and to create a community of support for everybody in recovery and people who know and love people who struggle with addiction issues and whatnot. So anyways, we're so glad you're here and thanks for listening. Hey listeners, just a quick disclaimer before we get into the interview. These episodes may contain adult language and subject matter that's not appropriate for all audiences. Also, we are not doctors or psychiatrists, so what we share on these episodes is certainly not to be considered medical or psychological advice, just our own personal experiences, which we hope will be helpful to others on a similar quest. So that's it. And thanks for listening. All right. Hey, sober family and our entire listener community. Today's guest is someone that I don't know personally, as well as, you know, I know some of the guests that I've had on, but it really makes for a different kind of interview. And anyone hangs out in the rooms inevitably hears people's stories because we have, you know, speaker meetings and whatnot. And to me, they really remind me of what it was like, what happened and what it's like now. And I love getting to explore people with fresh eyes. It's a huge gift. And so I don't know a ton about Ashley. And, you know, I haven't done all the research and looked at, you know, here's her whole life story before you even meet her. So this will be a new experience for both of us today. So, or for all of us today, I should say. So first of all, welcome, Ashley. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. It's great to be here.
Well, I'm happy to have you. I know we've seen each other and run in similar circles and whatnot, but your story will be pretty new to me. Other than, you know, conversations that we've had. And, you know, these tend to get a little heavy, not in a bad or sad way, but just, you know, there's a lot of ground that we cover. Some of it gets kind of emotional. So like, let's start with an icebreaker. If your life had a theme song, what would it be?
You know, I try not to over prepare for this, you know, when you gave me the questions, but I couldn't help but think, like, I'm in a talking heads phase right now, and I go through a couple of songs. You know, Burning Down the House has been my life for the last year. Psycho Killer, although I haven't really killed anybody, and She Was. So I'm floating through those three, but yeah, it's been a wild year. So you're catching me in it probably a little bit more interesting time.
Yeah. And, you know, I had prepared those questions. We had our interview scheduled for a while back, and then you had some things happen. And so I know I've gotten your permission to ask about that. But first, how long have you been sober? Like, what was your active addiction like? Let's kind of establish that first, and then we'll talk about kind of how you apply your recovery now to life shit, because it still certainly happens, right?
Exactly. Well, okay. So my sobriety date is January 2nd, 2009. So I'm a little over 15 years. I was the overachiever alcoholic addict. I really, really focused on my career and finding my worth through my success in my job. And I heard the speaker when I got sober early on. She said, the more I got promoted, the more I got loaded. And that was kind of my deal too. I had more, you know, a little bit more discretionary income. And so partying got more excessive. And I also picked an industry, advertising, that at the time was just a hotbed for happy hours all the time. So it was a perfect mix of toxicity and partying and ego too, because, you know, it's advertising and it's about ideas. So,
right.
Unfortunately though, right, I've always been I go back, like the first time I ever took ecstasy, I was like 17. And I stood up in the middle of this club and I said out loud, I want to feel like this for the rest of my life, you know? And so I had that, whatever we want to call it, you know, from the very beginning, there was never moderation for me. Why? What's the point? And unfortunately, that's not sustainable. So in the last couple of years of my career, I just couldn't show up. Well, I tried to show up. I was, you know, in an altered state, you know, got called on it a few times in the work environment. And I like to say this, it took me a year into sobriety to realize this, but I thought I had quit before they could fire me. But honestly, they fired me gently and, you know, moved me out of the role and gave me a severance package. And so, you know, I hit a pretty, and then I didn't get sober at that point. I still went one more year and it was like, let's use all that severance package. Let's do everything. The house was like, my house went into foreclosure. Like, let's see how bad we can get it. And then I finally raised my hand at age 35 and said, okay, I think I maybe need some help. And I was of the type that had been in and out of Al-Anon here and there because I always thought it was all the other people around me who had problems. So they call that like going in the back door. And so one night, man, I just, instead of turning left to go to Al-Anon, I turned right into AA and sat down and I was like, this is it. This is where I'm supposed to be. And so, and luckily I've been there ever since.
That's awesome. That's a great story. And a lot of our stories are just all over the map, and not even just AA, like all the different people and people's relationships with alcohol and these moments where they're like, what am I doing? And some of them are horrible. People are like, I had to go to prison for 15 years and lost everything and whatnot. And other people are, you know, so I like that we've got all these varied, but you know, what somebody's rock bottom is, or let's see how far I can push it. You know, those standards lowered for me anyways. It was like, at first it was like, wow, this is really terrible. And then 6 months from that point, I'd be like, oh, that's really not that bad. Like, you know, and it just devolved, as you know.
It sure does.
So you've had a really shitty, series of events, and I know it's life, and so we're not supposed to get into this thing of life isn't happening to us, right? Life is just blah, blah, blah. But still, sometimes you feel like you're under a personal fucking attack from the universe, or I've definitely felt that way before. Do you mind talking about the loss that you've experienced here in the last, you know, year or two, and what?
No, I mean, it's
what you've done to deal with it. No, and sober, right? To deal with it sober.
Yeah, sober. And God, what a shit show it would be if I wasn't sober, because it was already a shit show being sober. You know, I think I have to remind myself of that, because the further you are away from your last drink, you forget how crazy and chaotic it was.
Yeah.
You know, my mom was in, it's always always a little hard. So, you know, my mom drank as like I did. And she, you know, when you're in your 80s and your body's starting to break down, alcohol doesn't really help either. Yeah. And so we started getting the dreaded calls that she had fallen. You know, she kept falling. And, you know, they say that when you fall, when an elderly person falls, it's like kind of the beginning of the end. And even though I knew that that had happened with other family members, I definitely, you go into this panic mode. And, you know, so anyway, my mom, it was this, from the time she had her first fall to her actual death was maybe 4 months. And it went down fast. And, you know, what was unfortunately also happening is my stepfather, you know, he has some debt or something. So he had to work all day. So here's an 81-year-old woman sitting at home by herself for 12 hours drinking, you know, and she's miserable and she's calling me every hour crying and she's paranoid, and come to find out some dementia was kicking in too. And so it was heartbreaking to see her. And this is a woman who, by the way, I think she would say I need a little bit more makeup today, but she was a proper Southern mom. You know, outfits are perfect, matchy match, hair in place, lots of makeup. And when I, after that first fall, when I got to the house and I saw, you know, she hadn't taken care of herself and she wasn't being taken care of. Yeah. So I stepped in and our family, you know, we did the best we could. And then she ended up passing away in March of last year. And so mom was one of my very first people on my resentment, you know, my inventory list. We had a really tough relationship. She was a really tough, unhappy person. And I'll tell you what I did not expect in this experience was that I was able to nurture her in a way that she wasn't able to nurture me. And for some reason that was healing. And I was with her into the very end, into the very last breath. You know, she patted my hand and I think she felt safe with me. And that's a direct result of being, you know, an active sober member of in recovery. Yeah. And so it was sad, but it was super healing on top of it. You know, I just haven't been that close to death. And what I do want to say is throughout the whole experience, I had these, I guess you call them God shots, but like the hospice pastor was, you know, sober, you know? And so like, I had these moments in these craziness where it would pop up and it was like another reminder that my community was always around me. Yeah. So that was tough. And I, you know, I stood up and I gave her a eulogy and, I tried to wear a little bit more makeup that day. And I, you know, I felt like she deserved the dignity that the disease was that took from her at the end, you know, which it does to a lot of us. It takes away our dignity. So I feel like she's at rest now. And so, you know, it was brutal. And then I literally came home and 2 months later, my partner of 7 years literally just told me it was over. And we had just built a home. We had just been, it was like a new build 1 year maybe. And he was done and not interested in doing any work on the relationship. And so it was like this, I mean, I felt like it's interesting. Part of me gets a little mad at him because I don't know what it would have been like just to grieve my mom. I had to then grieve the fact that like, I'm not married. I don't have kids. My life was built with him. I'm now an orphaned adult because my dad has been passed away and now I have no partner. And now I'm 50 and I don't have a place to live. And it was, and still is, a challenge, but it brought me literally to my knees.
It's like rock bottom, but you're sober, right? Like a lot of us get to rock bottom because of our alcoholism or addictions or choices or series of events. And that it builds. And then you look around, you're like, holy shit, I've lost everything. But you were working your pro, you know? And so that's even got to be even harder to take, right? Of what do you want from me? I'm doing all the right things. And right. Like that's sometimes the reaction, but then it's like, nobody's out to get you, right? Like it's not personal, but it just feels, especially when you feel so alone in your grief. And I don't care how many people love you and are around you, we're still very alone with grief. I have a lot of support, but it's very lonely. And
that's right.
And then to have your partner walk out at a time when you needed him most, that's brutal, you know?
It was brutal. Like even my friends didn't even know what to say. My sponsor, nobody, everybody was like, I think when I started texting people, they didn't believe me. You know, it was that out of left field. And my family, you know, rallied. I have my brother and my sister-in-law and my two nieces, you know, were on the phone with me every day. And, you know, I do well in tough situations. Like, okay, I got to find a place to live. Okay, I got to do this. Okay, I got to do that. But when you finally get through like the logistics of, okay, I found a place to live and I moved and I sat down and I had celebrated my 15 years and I had to keep reminding myself that nothing was wrong with me because this happened.
Right.
Nothing is wrong with me. And that's my default. Why couldn't I have seen this? Why couldn't I have, you know, prepared for this or avoided this or, you know, all the second guessing.
And the illusion that we have control, right?
That's right. That's right. And of course, you know, our parents are going to pass away. You know, of course, my mom's suffering from alcoholism. It wasn't going to be pretty, even though I didn't really think that far in advance.
Right.
You know, if I wasn't sober, you know, there's that saying they always say, like, it's like insurance every meeting you go to. Mm-hmm. It's like a little bit of insurance. And I, you know, I understood what they meant, but until this year happened, there's absolutely no way if I hadn't been grounded in the program, grounded in a community of women and connected to a spiritual, you know, power, there's no way I wouldn't have drank. I'm going to be honest. I would not have drank. I would have taken the other alternative, you know, that where I don't want to exist. And I had those moments, but the good thing about it is the second thought after those first thoughts are, you've worked too hard. Yeah. You have worked too hard and somewhere inside of me said, this is your moment to finally really become who you're supposed to be.
Yeah.
I know, as alcoholics, we to go right into it, don't we?
I know, I'll just get right into it. Well, and I've heard a lot of sayings around, like, you know, rejection is protection and like these different things, right? And so sometimes these tower moments or whatever, like things get removed from our lives and it's very painful. And then later you realize, but I think too of admitting that we still have those thoughts, right? That feeling that whatever it is permanent. And like, it's not. And I think that's what recovery teaches, is that you're going to have to work through some really hard stuff. You're going to have no anesthesia, but you do have support and you do have tools. And if you'll push through, then this shit's going to go away. But for me, even now, I mean, it probably forever, like when something happens, I'm like, this is it. I'm going to feel like this for the rest of my life. Like,
that's right.
I'll never get out of this feeling or this loss or this feeling of, like, you know, wanting to blame myself when things happen around me. But that's like exactly you said, right. And my sponsor used to always say, first thought wrong, first thought wrong, first thought wrong. Like whatever your first thought is, throw it out the window, go get a second opinion. Like don't follow your ideas. Like go put it out there to somebody, whether it's in a meeting or a, you know, and then I would look back and my first thought was always pretty destructive. Still is. Yeah. My first reflex is pretty destructive. Yeah.
I have to say, I don't have to make an amends. That to me is like the most amazing thing. Is able to not burn the fucking house down.
Yeah.
You know, I'm told I walked through with some grace and dignity. I mean, I tucked in though. And here's what I'll tell you. The aftermath of it was I wasn't sleeping. I was having constant flashbacks of my mom in the hospital. I was obviously couldn't eat. I couldn't stop crying. You know, and I ended up going to the doctor and they diagnosed me with complex PTSD. And, you know, what I realized also is this was a moment that it cracked me open, but it cracked me open on other parts of me that I haven't been able to get to.
Yeah.
Like that still needed work.
Mm-hmm.
The grief of my dad, you know, he passed away when I was 8. I kind of thought I had dealt with it, you know, but the abandonment stuff, where do I fit in the world? What is my value? It just, it opened me up in the most painful way. But what the program taught me was one, ask for help. I mean, I raised my hand like, holy shit, I'm hanging on the side of the boat. And I had a great group of friends around me. I'm lucky that I had the access to doctors. I instinctively, this is a weird thing, and I love this because it's just a little example of the program working on you. I'm an isolator. I like to tuck in and to, you know, I'm notorious of being like, oh, Ashley's in one of her phases. She'll poke her head up in a little bit. I knew instinctively that if I got a place, my home, when I moved out of my house with my dogs, if I got a home or moved into some type of home, that I would never leave the house. And so for some reason, intuitively, it said, get an apartment because you're going to have to walk the dogs. And I know that sounds so simple, but that's how basic we had gotten to. It's like, today I'm going to get up and walk the dogs. And then it's going to be a good day. Or it's a day that I was able to get up and walk the dogs. So, you know, it's been a year since all of this, almost a full year that all this has played out. And then to add a little bit of insult to injury, I'll just like finish with this. And this is why we were supposed to meet before, but my oldest dog, she ended up having heart failure and I had to put her down. So it's been a lot of grief.
Yeah. One of my questions was, if you had like one oh shit handle in the program, you know, like what is it? Because a lot of people, when they're new or they go through crisis or loss, even well into recovery, everybody has that one thing that kind of snaps them out of it, you know? What is yours? Do you have one?
Yeah, you know, there's probably two that are most relevant to me in the sense, like I am a deep feeler, a big feeler, and I had a bottom, but I had an emotional bottom that was, you know, we talk about demoralization or whatever that saying is in the book, but it's like for me, it's check the facts. Check the facts, Ashley. Now bad stuff can be happening, but my interpretation of it also is where I get in the rabbit hole.
Right.
And so that, you know, check the facts, am I saying to myself, is it true? Is it real? Is it kind? Is it compassionate? Because most of the time it isn't.
Yeah.
And the other thing I would say is feelings aren't facts. So it's kind of two sides of the same coin for me, because I literally feel like and have felt like my feelings are going to kill me. That's how big and scary they are.
Yeah, they're overwhelming. They just consume you. I get it.
That's right. That's right. And they're going to drive me mad or something, you know?
Yeah.
So that has been helpful for me through the years.
I love check the facts, because it's almost like if you look at a fact on a piece of paper, then it is what it is. But if you listen to the, like a pundit, let's say, and all this conjecture and all this shit and the swirling and all the rabbit holes and the ideas, like to me, that's what my mind can do, right? I want to turn this fact into all this other stuff that isn't factual at all, which typically if I do a nightly or I share about it in a meeting or I talk to another sober woman, they're like, that's a leap to go from this to that, right? Like, and then you realize you're right. I'm doing it, right? I'm catastrophizing the shit out of everything because that's how my mind, because it's a, for me, it's a protection mode, right? If I can like go to worst case scenario, then I'm prepared for that bad thing to happen. Right. And if I don't do that, then I don't feel safe because I don't want to get surprised, right? I don't want I don't want things to happen that I'm not expecting. Because I need control, right? Everything. And so it's like And then that powerlessness that our literature talks about and that we are always asked to surrender to, that reminder of the powerlessness. But I love that, like check the facts. It's such a, and for me, putting pen to paper, like, okay, what are the facts? Okay, now on this side, what is it that my brain is turning this into? And that's, I love that. Well, what is the best part of getting sober? Let's have a happy question. Like, what's the best part for you?
Oh my God. I've had so much fun in sobriety. I mean, I really have. I like to take on big goals, you know, it's kind of my personality. And so like, you know, I can't, and I still, even in sobriety, I don't do moderation well, but it's like, oh, I want to get in shape. So I decide to do a triathlon instead of like just a running race, you know, like the next thing you know, I've done like 7 half Ironmans and, you know, trained for a full. And I mean, so just getting to try and do things and push myself in a different way has been really rewarding. I'd say honestly, though, is the clarity in general that I just bring to the table. Anybody who knows me pre-sobriety would not say that I was necessarily even keeled and rational. And now I'm able to like get perspective on things, and it just makes my life a lot easier. I'm sure a lot of people around me do, but you know, my brother always says it to me a lot, like, you're so clear-headed. And it's like, that's right. That's what sobriety, and not just staying sober, but, you know, committed to this spiritual development path.
Right.
Has kind of built some like internal scaffolding where I feel stronger and better as a person.
I love that. That's really powerful. And you forget, like you said earlier, the further you get, farther you get away from your last drink. Because I spoke with a woman last weekend that I'm pretty close to, and she just came out of a pretty gnarly relapse. And I forgot what it was like. I'll see newcomers here and there, and I'll hear things and I'll be like, oh, yikes, it's still like that. Okay, cool. Good to know. But for someone, you know, that you saw come in and then you saw get sober and have this like light come back on, and then to come out of a relapse, like knowing that, it reminded me of how painful, you know, and crazy and scary it gets and how quickly it can get that way. And I think like, when you're talking about that clarity, I take that for granted. I take so much for granted until I talk to someone or I hear something in a meeting, and I'm like, it's such a normal thing now to wake up clear-headed. And even if I'm sad or I'm feeling whatever, like even hormonal or like shit's going on at work or whatever, I still have that clarity, right? And I'm still able to react in a sane way usually. But I never want to forget, you know, it scares me when I realize that I have forgotten how bad it was. Because my mind has paved over a lot of that.
Yeah, I don't ever want to get sober again. I don't ever, I did not have a pink cloud. It was not, you know, I picked up my, I think that when I picked up my 60-day chip, I wanted to punch everybody in the face. I cried for, you know, like 6 months. It was brutal. And, you know, there was this old timer that always had in the rooms. And I went to 2 meetings a day for the first year because I didn't have a job. And I could, you know, so I was literally like, I'll just go where you tell me to go. So I went to a noon and an 8 every day, noon, 8. And there's this old timer in the noon who would always say, you know, we're out there, we're juggling a bunch of rocks. And then we come in here and we sit down and all those rocks come falling down. And that's what my first year was like. It was not pink cloud. I'm always so impressed with the people who are like, oh my God, you have rainbows and sunshine. And I'm like, oh, I have some wreckage, you know, I had to clean up some wreckage. So I hope to never have to do that again.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. And it's a lot easier to stay sober even than it is to get sober. But there are times where you're like, God, what am I doing this for? Life is still so hard. Like, especially when you're going through something, it's like I should be rewarded for recovery by not having to experience this kind of bullshit, you know? But we know that's not a thing. I love the rock analogy too, because that's what it feels. And I didn't have a pink cloud either. It was absolutely miserable. I felt like I was going to crawl out of my skin. Everything made me angry. I was crying. I was having all these feelings. I couldn't make them go away. I was in a panic. I was having panic attacks. I mean, it was horrible. Couldn't sleep, didn't eat. But once I got into the step work and started realizing, okay, fine. And she goes, I'm going to hold the flashlight. You're going to dig and we're going to get into it. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay. And it made me at least feel good that there was something I could do about it.
Do.
And that it wasn't permanent. Again, that was that feeling. Those feelings were going to lift eventually, but I couldn't see it at the time. So I had to believe what people told me, that it was going to get better, you know?
Well, I think what you said earlier, like the delusion that because I get sober means I'm going to be protected from anything that bad else happening again. Naive to think that, but I did think that. And I thought that the quality of my program equated the quality of how life was happening around me. Mm-hmm. Now, in some regards it is, but most of the time, if you're sober, you know, and you're doing your part, life just happens. And that was a hard lesson for me at year 3, I think, where I bottomed out emotionally and I had to go get some extra help for some trauma. And, you know, praying it away wasn't working at the time, but I kept thinking, oh my God, like I'm supposed to be Miss AA, you know, I'm known to work a good program. I'm known to you know, do my worksheets and my assignments and I know the book and, you know, and I wasn't getting relief. And it's like, it's a human experience. Just because I'm sober doesn't mean that I get that pass from the human experience.
No, nor do we want one. But there are times where you want to find the escape hatch when you're in pain and you can't make it go away. And that's why we drank. We ran from that kind of stuff. And it doesn't happen in a week or two. Like it can be months or years going through grieving process and whatnot, or dealing with trauma or getting outside help with, you know, therapy, medication, whatever people need. But, you know, I think that my assumptions about all of that was very much tied to my religious upbringing, right? Of the better you are, the more God will reward you. And if you're bad, well, then God will punish you. So I thought if I'm a straight A student in AA, then the sober gods or God or whatever will reward me. And then when I fuck up, well, then I'll get, you know, punished and bad things will happen. I mean, it was very tied to that because as a small child, you were taught like, if you're good, good things happen. If you're bad, bad things happen. Like it's that simple, right? And your worth is very much tied to that. And it took me a long time to realize only by watching other people go through stuff, losing spouses, losing children, losing houses and careers and all that in recovery, and watching them lean in, come to more meetings, help more people, take more service positions. Like I was like, oh, okay. I guess shit still happens for sure. That kind of childish concept of, if I'm a good girl, then everyone will like me and I won't ever have to be uncomfortable again.
Ugh. Yeah. You know, this past year was also an exercise in me being vulnerable with the like going into the rooms of AA and being like, hey, this is, yeah, I got 15 years and my ass is on fire and I'm scared. And doing it in front of sponsees and doing it in front of, you know, people that have watched me over the last 15 years, that also kept me sober. Cause I had to bear my soul. I had to be honest about what was going on instead of coming in with an ego that says, oh, I've got this under control at 15, you know, for some, you know, I'm a double digit sobriety gangster and I wasn't, you know, but maybe I actually was in the end because I was taught.
You did the program.
Instinctively. Yeah. Ask for help.
You asked for help. And I went through the same thing when my pop got diagnosed. I would not talk about it at my home group. And this is crazy looking back on it. I would not talk about it in my home group because I had sponsees in there and people looked up to my program and they told me that, and I didn't want to disappoint them. I didn't want to burden them. I didn't want them to think that the program wasn't working or something. It was a lot of ego, a lot of like whatever. Mm-hmm. And so I went to another meeting where no one knew me to cry and to talk about my pop and to talk about my fear and cancer and my relationship with him and blah, 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 whatever. And it took me a while. And I was talking to my sponsor at the time and she said, you need to talk about it in our meeting. And I didn't want to, but I did. And I felt better and I got so much support. And there were other women there who had been through that experience, losing a parent and whatnot. But it took me a long time. And the one place that I really needed to be vulnerable and needed to ask for help, I just wouldn't do it. Because I didn't want people to think less of me or my program. And I also didn't want to disappoint other people. Because I was supposed to be happy, right? I love AA. I love being sober. This is fucking awesome, right? I'd come in and I'm just like so happy. But then when things would happen, I would pretend to be. Yeah, so I totally get that. It's such a weird.
Ego, man. Ego is such a powerful thing still, right? It still wants to, you know, latch on to me and be like, how do you look? How what do people think? Blah, 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 blah. You know, it's just, it's exhausting sometimes, but yeah.
But you think my ego tricks me into thinking that I'm doing it for someone else, right? Like that was the thing is like, I don't want to burden my sponsees. I don't want to bring the energy down in my home group, right? It was like martyr, like, you know, it's just bullshit looking back. But at the time it made perfect sense to me. But like you said, I needed to tell my sponsor, I am in trouble. I am in trouble. I'm scared. I feel very alone with this situation. I don't know what to do. And I've shared about it in these other meetings. And she's like, well, that's why, because they don't know you. Like you have to receive love. You're not willing to receive love and support because I will give the love and I will give the support, but I don't really do well receiving it from people. It makes me feel really weird, even to this day, you know?
Same. And I actually felt like I was wearing people down this year, like how much more shit could happen to me that I had to lean on people, you know, like literally like I have, my quota is up. And it was like, no, like, we are there for each other. Yeah. And there will be my time to be there for somebody else, you know? Yeah. So it's a beautiful thing.
What do you think was the most helpful thing anyone said to you when you were getting sober? Because people always have all these things to say and whatnot. But like, I want to know what was the most helpful thing, even if it was before you got sober, maybe as you were thinking about it or realizing that there was a problem. So what was like the most helpful thing? And then what was the least helpful thing?
You know, I don't have a lot of memories. I mean, I have some.
Yeah.
It was hazy for me. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, I had the standard, you know, friend saying, oh, where's the Ashley that I used to know? That didn't help. You know, like I was like, F off. Where's my drink? I honestly, when I went to my first AA meeting, I was greeted at the door And I went, and it was an older gentleman. His name was Lou. I'll never forget Lou. I don't know where Lou is. But Lou remembered my name when I came back. And he said, "Hey, Ashley, the next night, glad you're back." And that's what stuck with me.
Wow.
I hadn't, you know, the power of the group, the power of the people, you know, the hand of AA is really a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
If you find the right people and are in the right groups, you know, I mean, as with everything, but I just was like, they want me here. Yeah. And I need to be here.
Yeah. Yeah. It reminds me of that "we'll love you until you learn how to love yourself" type of feeling of like, because by that point, typically in our drinking careers or whatever, we've been shunned by other people or we've shunned them to protect ourselves. And I had shunned my own self. I had so much shame that I came in with. And so for somebody to just be like, I remember at one of my first meetings, we held hands at the end and said a prayer, or whatever we did. And somebody said, "Welcome home" to me. And I just lost my shit. I started crying. It was just this feeling of, it's kind of like, welcome home. Like, what? But I knew in my heart, like you said, when you went from Al-Anon to AA, you just knew. And I knew instantly. I was like, this is where I'm meant to be. Now, I didn't get sober right away. And I went through many relapses. So I wasn't some one-chip wonder or whatever. But like, I knew in my bones, those were my people. And that's what I needed to do. But I wasn't ready to give up. I was going to try to control it, which went great, as you can imagine.
you know what didn't help me was the whole, and I say this out of respect, put the plug in the jug, sit down and shut up. I understand the being a newcomer and not having all the answers, but I had a group that allowed me to share where I was in early sobriety.
Yeah.
That connected me to them. And so if I had to, you know, put the cotton from the, what did they say? In your ear, in your mouth or something, just all the old timer sayings. As much as I respect and I understand the need to preserve the original message of AA, there are certain groups that I needed to find where I was allowed to share and be emotional.
Absolutely. Some people don't respond well to that like tough love thing, and we need to be able to share. And also finding a meeting or a group, whatever your deal is, where you're allowed to say whatever the truth is, you know? And so I don't want somebody to come get on to me because I mentioned drug use in an AA meeting. Like, that is part of my story. I did a lot of things, not just drinking, but all these rulesy people would come jump my ass after certain meetings. And I was like, this is not helpful. Like, I get it. Like, to your point, I respect the tradition and everything, but that wasn't my meeting, right? I needed a place where, and that's what I love about our meetings and my home group in Austin when I was still in Austin, was like, you could just be honest and say what you needed to say. And I never felt judged for it. So,
yeah, you know, it's funny because I got to be careful too. Like, I don't want to go to a therapy meeting. I've been to therapy. I want to be in an AA meeting. So I understand like what the traditions are trying to do and what we need to, you know, singleness of purpose. And I very much believe in it, especially now with all the plant-based stuff happening and the confusion that I think it brings to newcomers. Or the loophole that allows people to jump through, or at least my addictive mind would jump through that loophole. I understand it, but I also, you know, there is a group out there for everyone that has the style that is best for you.
Yes, yes. And that's one of the things I loved about that Sunday meeting that we were talking about earlier, was that it was a big book study. And so we were rooted in the literature, we were rooted in the teachings, but we also could expand and like apply those teachings to our day-to-day lives and situations. And it just felt very spacious. And I really like that because I never want to get too far away. Like you said, I already have a therapist. I don't need that in my meetings, right? I need program. but not like people who are so rigid to the point where they, right. And so the balance, right, which I keep telling myself, she's always like, balance, Amanda, balance. I'm like, I've never heard of it. I still, to this day, I'm like, what do you mean? Like, to you, I can't just get in shape. Like, I have to go do CrossFit and run races and go absolutely apeshit, you know? Not now, because my body was like, by the way, your knees aren't going to do that anymore.
So true.
How have things changed with your relationships in recovery? Not only the relationships themselves, but like your perspectives on relationships. And that can be with friends or lovers or your mom, your relationships in general.
Well, less chaotic, less dishonesty, obviously.
Yeah.
I wasn't necessarily a stealer or a liar. I was just I couldn't show up. You know, you wouldn't get like a Christmas card from me, or I might show up for Christmas one year, or, you know, like it wasn't, you know, down by the river, me breaking furniture and stuff. It was just like, how reliable was I going to be? And, at least in my relationships, I will say I have shifted my focus in the last year to ACA purposely because I still really, there was some like, it's almost like the last piece of the puzzle for me of that, how when, if you think about alcohol as a disease that infects a family, it therefore it infects how you perceive the world and interact with the world. I still have issues with getting small, right? And I have this one part of me that likes to be the what does my therapist call it? She calls it the go along to get along. Like, I don't want to ruffle any feathers. I don't want to be difficult. I don't want to be labeled a Karen. And in that, I self-abandon a lot. Mm-hmm. And I find myself, the AA thing of like, just accept people for where they are. Well, yes, accept people for where they are. But also the next question that I have learned for me, it's a hard lesson, is it enough for me? And sometimes it hasn't been, and I've stayed anyway. And then I look back and go, oh my God, I just completely abandoned myself in that relationship. So that's where, you know, I still have a lot of work to do on that, and a lot of things to unlearn around that, and that it's okay for me to be unapologetically me. That sounds so cheesy, but that's where I'm at. So, you know, my intimate relationships have gotten better, but I also chose a person that had the ability to turn like that in my worst time. Yeah. That says something, like, you know, to me, it's a reminder of like, I'm still maybe not choosing the right people.
Right. And to your point, well, for our listeners who don't know what ACA stands for, it's Adult Children of Alcoholics. And it is, there's AA, there's Al-Anon, there's all kinds of, you know, support groups. But, and your mom died of this disease, as you explained earlier. And so that's obviously shapes our upbringings, our perspectives, how we show up in relationships, how we behave in relationships, most importantly, our relationship with ourselves, right? And to your point, we can accept people where they are, but we are also entitled and allowed to have boundaries and to enforce those boundaries. And I think that's the hard part, right? I'm not going to change you or tell you that how you are isn't okay with me, but I am going to peacefully remove myself from the situation because it's not enough for me. And you don't even have to tell them that, right? It's just like, but we have to be able to do that consistently. And my patterns and relationships are the same. It's like, I can't help but pick people who have abandonment issues. And so somebody's going to abandon first because they don't want to get abandoned. And we continue to remanufacture the same scenario from childhood until we finally whatever. I don't even know. Stop abandoning ourselves, I guess. I mean, I love that term that you use, self-abandonment. It's like, whoa. Because we're always worried about abandoning people or being abandoned. But what about like my 7-year-old self? You know, what about my 48-year-old self right now? Like, what about all of that? You know? And so thank you for sharing that. That's huge.
Yeah, it's huge. I mentioned that I'm writing right now, and that is one of the themes, is this chronic self-abandonment. And it really does stem from trauma and alcoholism, mm-hmm. In the family. And it is just, you know, I'm a performer. If I perform, you're going to like me. And for the most part, like I kind of have a big personality in my professional life, and I've been successful that way. But in my personal life, I have big personalities around me, and I get small, and I can't play small anymore.
Yeah. What's your biggest, well, do you want to talk about what you have going on in that realm?
Sure.
Or not really?
Okay. Some practice. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, like I said, I don't do anything in moderation. And I thought it was a really good idea during this whole past year to write a book. Honestly, I mean, you know, why I thought that was a good idea, but actually it's been an amazing idea. I joke about that. I have always wanted to be a writer. I've written in different capacities in my career and through my life and, you know, all kinds of stuff here and there. But again, never really had the courage or the confidence to go for it. And for some reason this past year, I was like, let's go. You've abandoned yourself enough. Let's go. So I decided that I wanted to write a book that followed this last year. It chronicles this last year, and it's called Underbelly, which you can understand why it's called Underbelly. The underbelly, like the shit that nobody wants to talk about and how messy and ugly it is. And it's a year in grief and healing. And it is, you know, I'd like to think I'm as good as him, but it's the David Sedaris like in tone, because I have to have a sense of humor and I have to find humor in the thing. But it is raw and it's real. And it's, you know, grief is kind of having this moment right now where people are talking about it's okay. And like we're paying attention to the fact that in our society, you only get 3 days of bereavement at your job. If, you know, your mom dies, it's like 3 days. Think about that, you know, or like, once you get through the 5 steps of grief, then, you know, move along. And, you know, even people close to me, a close person, you know, I think it was 6 months into all this stuff happening to me, said, "You're still really upset about all this, aren't you?" And I'm thinking, yeah. And so you realize what it is people get uncomfortable, especially with grief, because it makes you think about your end destination. And, you know, it's just, it's a messy experience. So I decided to put it all down on paper for you. So it really highlights sobriety, relationships, self-abandonment, you know, tools, all the tools that I've been able to use and bring to bear for me to get through the year, and a lot of love and humor, you know? Mm-hmm. So I got greenlit this week. So I have my first full draft. I cannot believe it.
Exciting. Okay. So greenlit means what? It's going to do the thing and whatnot. Like, when will it be out? It's called Underbelly.
Yeah. That means the publisher looked over it. It's a viable draft manuscript. They feel comfortable that we will get to production, and they're very excited about it. And so, So by the end of the year, I should have my book in hand. And, you know, I'm still having moments of like, oh, I'm going to have to tell, like, even telling you about my mom's alcoholism is hard for me, because we had our family is very private, you know, like I have days where I'm like, oh my God, am I really bearing my soul like this? And then it's like, I had someone read some of my book the other day, and he wrote back to me, "If the rest of your book is like this, you're going to help a lot of people." And that just made me feel a lot of relief that I know to be true when we're honest about where we're at, we help people.
And I think, well, first of all, congratulations. I mean, that's incredible.
Thank you.
And I love the fact that you got to probably use that as a form of catharsis, but you're also going to, you know, pay it forward, help other people. And we all know that we all need permission almost to, we see someone else talking about something and we're like, shit, I need to talk about this, you know? And it's this fake toxic positivity of our society where we're all supposed to be happy all the time. And God forbid you're having an issue. Because when people ask you, how are you? They don't really care. They want you to say fine. You know, how are you? Fine. Cool. Have a good day. Like, right. We're not trying to like get all, but that's why everything is so superficial sometimes. And I love it when people are willing to just get messy out in public. But like when you were talking about your, it made me cry earlier. I'm probably going to cry now, but like when you lose a parent, something really weird happens, like cosmically. And
yes,
you're just like untethered. I don't know. It's a really weird feeling. And I just experienced that like 18 months ago, and I had never lost a parent before. So I wasn't prepared. And we had a complicated relationship. It had unearthed everything from my childhood that I thought I had dealt with in therapy. And, but it also freed me from fear of not being enough for him. A lot of that was like self-imposed. Those were expectations that I put on myself because I watched the expectations he put on himself. So again, my imagination, my mind created a lot of ideas around a fact that he's a tough guy and he expects a lot from himself and people around him. And I turned that into, I'm never good enough. And I'm never going to be good enough. Right. So again, I'm not blaming him. It's just, I did not expect for this messy ball of fucking feelings, anger, resentment, regret, wishing I could go back and do it over with my pop in a different way. Like just, and then like not liking the way my brothers are grieving, not appreciating the way other people are doing it or not doing it. You know, why won't anyone let me talk about this? Oh, you guys are uncomfortable. Well, what about me? I need to talk about it. Right. And I want to talk about it with my people, people who we share the same blood, and they won't talk about it. And so, you know, that makes me feel alone. But again, it's going back to the stuff you're talking about of like, good on you for documenting all that. Cause I don't, even just thinking about it gets me worked up.
Yeah. It's some days are better than others when I'm writing. What I thought I could, let me say this, what I thought I could do, because I think I'm funny and I like my snark, is I thought I could write these really painful experiences with some snark at the end. And yeah. I can, and I did, but I had to get really honest, and I was not, you know, it's like, okay, this endeavor sounds fun and it's good for my ego and blah, blah, blah. But it was like, no, like when I really got into it, it was like, you cannot, people will know when you're not being authentic.
Yep.
And you can feel it. You know, here we go. So we'll see. I mean, I don't really care of the outcome of the book. I'm just so grateful to have given myself the permission to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. You didn't make yourself small. You stayed big and honest and true to yourself, and you're putting it out there, and it is going to help a lot of people. And I think that, you know, we talk about rule 62 in the program and don't take yourself so seriously. And don't forget, like lighten up, right? Like have some fun and have some humor. And as tragic as some of the stories are in our family, they're hilarious, fucking hilarious. So like, but the juxtaposition is really weird and a lot of people don't get it. My sense of humor is off. And so, you know, I make a lot of people feel uncomfortable and I try to be sensitive to that, but those aren't my people. Like, you know what I mean? Like I know, and I know, I know your the sense of humor and your story and whatnot, much better now than before. But I can't wait to read it. So do you have any idea when it could possibly be out in the world?
Yeah.
I mean, by the end December. Of the year, does that mean like by December? Okay.
December 15th, something around there.
Okay.
I just want to like put an exclamation point on that last thing about humor, right? My dog, I had to put my dog down and I laughed, but I wasn't laughing. And this was, you know, one of my babies. And it was like a week before Valentine's Day this year. And, you know, I've been taking a lot of naps. Thank God I have a flexible work situation. And on Valentine's Day, I was like, okay, this manufactured day, whatever. I lay down for a nap and then the door knocked and there was a delivery man and it was with my dog's ashes. And I could not stop laughing because I was just like, this is what it is. Like my dog who is like, she was such a little asshole. It's like her last word. And she's going to be on Valentine's Day. Let's just make it like Hollywood ridiculous.
That is
so that's how my book ends. You know, like we got to find some humor.
Yeah. It's your soulmate. And also that's hilarious. And it's just like, it's like a rom-com, but with a dark little, well, I would like to end on this question, which is just, you know, I'm always super curious about people's spirituality because I go to secular meetings. I go to like Zen, I'm all over the place, right? I'm just super open to it. But I also see people who are pretty strict about like certain things. And so like, how has your concept of a higher power changed or evolved? Like, what does that look like for you in your program, in your life?
Good question. I wanted nothing to do with it when I got sober. I'm a, what do they call it? A recovering Catholic, which is very much like you were saying, like, it's a punishing God. It feels like a punishing God to me.
Guilt and fear. And,
You know, it's, and it's performance, you know, if I do good then and then I'll be good. So it has evolved. I've always been seeking some sort of spiritual connection. Like before I got sober, I do yoga and church hop and, you know, all these different things. But honestly, it's really simple and it doesn't make any sense to me now, but it's just a loving spirit that gives me intuitive thoughts and a peacefulness that I haven't experienced before. And so you know, am I praying to baby Jesus? No. But I am praying to, I just say God to help me walk through life loosely and show me the path, you know, show me the path and the path keeps revealing itself. And so I don't know. I spent years and years in therapy and I didn't get that result. And so there is something bigger than me. I don't know what it is. I don't care to try to figure it out. Yeah. It's just if I keep trying to do, stay connected to it, most of my life is taken care of.
Yeah. That's beautiful. I love that. It's so spacious. And the big book even talks about the highway of spirituality is broad and roomy and all inclusive and blah, 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 right?
Yep.
As long as you're seeking. And it doesn't have to be your God or his God or whatever. It's just like seeking something bigger than yourself, getting out of self, getting out of ego and like trying to. And for me, it's collective consciousness. It's definitely got a very female nature type of, you know, whatever. But to your point, it's peace. And I think when I was saying earlier that in our grief, we're completely alone, I should have, for me, actually, my higher power is the only one that's in the trenches with me.
That's right.
And it's not the same because I'm like an empirical data kind of girl. Like I like to see shit and like know what it is and stuff. So it's hard for my logical brain. It's hard for me to get out of my logical brain into my heart space and be like, okay, I'm just going to let this. But there's a peace that has come over me when I've been in the saddest times of my life and having flashback nightmares of my pop at the end and all of that stuff. And I felt this, I was just enveloped with comfort and warmth, you know? And I don't know what that is. And I don't really care. I don't need to know anymore. I used to, I had to know before I would believe. And now I just like, I don't know. I believe because I've experienced it. Right.
That's right.
So
that's exactly right. And that, yeah. Some people will say they've heard me say this a lot. We're all on the same track. Some of us have just done a few more laps than others. And those laps have given me a sense of trust that I'm going to be okay.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that's what it is.
That's it. It's just more experience of having gotten through some more things because of more time. Yeah. I love that. Well, I can't thank you enough for joining today. This has been emotional and cathartic and enlightening, and you're amazing. And I'm so excited for your book, and I'm sorry you've been through it, but I know that you're, you know, transmuting all that pain into goodness. And I'm really honored to know you.
Yeah. Thank you so much. I love what you're doing. I think it's an important conversation, and I felt privileged to be here. So thank you.
Thank you.